You are listening to the Global Security Podcast from Johns Hopkins University's Krieger School of Arts and Sciences, Advanced Academic Programs in Washington, D.C. Sitting in my office today is Dr. Michael Warner. Michael's an old friend, and he's also a historian with the Department of Defense at this time, and previously has been the chief historian for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And before that, he was for quite a number of years on the CIA history staff. He's got a long and distinguished career in the field that we're going to be talking about today. Mike has his PhD from the University of Chicago, and I would be remiss if I didn't also mention that among many other endeavors, he also teaches here in the Global Security Studies program at Johns Hopkins Advanced Academic Programs. So, Michael Warner, welcome to the Global Security Podcast. Want to talk today about the your new book that you have out. Congratulations on that. It's called The Rise and Fall of Intelligence and International Security History. Came out from Georgetown University Press, I think, in May. Is that right?
March,
okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I know from painful experience myself, getting a book published is, well, it's painful, so congratulations on surviving that ordeal. Mm-hmm. So I just want to start here for a minute or two, and can you tell me, what are your views on what are the origins of intelligence? Sort of, where do the roots go back to for this thing that we think of today as very sort of, you know, high-tech kind of endeavor? Where does it really start, in your view?
Sure. Mark, thank you very much for having me here today. It's great to be down at Hopkins in the summertime. Usually I'm here in the spring teaching, but it's fun to get into D.C. And welcome the opportunity to talk to you about this. Intelligence really goes back pretty much to the dawn of civilization. They have found baked clay balls, I guess you would call them, in the ruins of the city of Uruk, which is in Iraq now. And these are probably date to about 3500 BC. And they've got little tokens inside of them, which denote value of some sort. And they are in essentially tamper-proof containers so that you could send messages of how much you had to buy or sell to somebody else. And somebody else in between was not able to get the information from you
there. It was an early form of secure communication.
Absolutely. It predates writing. It predates mathematics. And so you can sort of see that the desire to keep things secret from prying eyes goes back to really the dawn of cities and the dawn of human society there. So we've been at this business for a very long time.
So your book then, the subtitle of your book is An International Security History. But your book focuses primarily, not exclusively, but primarily on British, American, and Russian/Soviet intelligence. Why? There's a lot of countries in the world, most of them with intelligence services. Why those three?
Well, what I tried to do was to look at who is innovating in the intelligence business. You'll notice I talk quite a bit about the French in World War I, for instance, when they're pioneering tactical signals intelligence and imagery intelligence there. We talk about the East Germans and how good they get at internal security. And so we're looking at who is innovating, who is driving the business of intelligence forward, who is coming up with new ways of doing things. On the converse for that, I leave the United States almost entirely out of the picture for several millennia of human existence there, and really they're not very important players up until World War II. They're not really very innovative. They're following what other people do up until World War II.
Would you care to speculate then on what it is that makes the British, the Americans, and the Russians/Soviets be, you know, the leading innovators? Not always the only innovators, but why is it that those three countries were really the ones who, more often than not, were pushing the bounds of the possible, pushing the state of the art?
That is a fascinating question there. In the British case, it's national survival, and I also think it's something to do with the way the British government works. They tend to gravitate to committees. They tend to look at things from a joint or interagency, inter-service perspective there. And they're also very technologically astute, especially in this early age right here. They have a Royal Navy to coordinate coordinate, which is all around the world. They've got the air defense of the British Isles to run in World War One. They've also got the big tactical land problem in World War One as well. And so their intelligence is challenged like no one else's is. They get very good at this. They turn tactical intelligence into a strategic asset. The Russians, really the Soviets, are particularly innovative. They invent party intelligence for the party,
the Communist Party.
Exactly, the sword and shield of the party, where intelligence is, it guards the regime inside, it guards and extends the regime's influence outside. It is a tool there for the party to use. It's a way of driving forward and preserving the revolution. That's a new thing in the intelligence world. For the Americans, what the Americans get particularly good at is large-scale application of very, very capable, very expensive machines. They bring computerization to intelligence. They don't invent the computer, but they're close to the invention of the computer there. They invent satellite intelligence. They are among the innovators in computer digital intelligence at the end of the Cold War as well. Certainly in the computer security field, they're very good at that. And so these are ways in which each of these societies gets very innovative.
So you're not really making and we'll get ultimately here in this discussion to the sort of the big arc of your argument, but you're not really making a technologically determinist argument. Technology is a big part of that, and maybe it's one that we Americans arguably are most inclined to think about, but that the development of intelligence in the modern era, at least, has been pushed not only by technology, but by political and strategic sorts of concerns as well.
Certainly by the political and strategic sorts of concerns. Technology is a constraint upon those political and strategic concerns there. There's ideological concerns there. Technology gives you the bounds for those. Technology creates the bar at which a nation has to cross to become competitive in the intelligence business there. So it's not a technological determinism. It's more of a soft determinism. A great deal of possibility is left there if you pass certain technological tests.
Well, speaking of technology, you have this wonderful phrase that I believe you personally coined. I'm open to being corrected on that. But the phrase is the analog revolution. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what is this analog revolution? I find it a very interesting and very appealing idea.
Well, it really, you could almost call it the electrical revolution, or it's a revolution in the amount of data that can be collected and processed.
And when does this happen?
This is World War One and beyond there. They're not calling it data at that point there, but it's collection by machine, and often these machines are electronic or there's something electrical involved in the processing there. It's signals intelligence, it's communications, it's imagery intelligence. Now I know that isn't really electrical, but there's a whole lot of dissemination that is taking place by electrical means or facilitated in that way. It's the application, the beginning of the application of science to intelligence there. This analog revolution really extends forward into the 1960s, into the fielding of satellites, the use of satellites to collect signals from space and to take pictures from space there. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Moving toward that.
It just seems to me that, let me rephrase this. Would it be fair to say that while, sort of the invention of signals intelligence as we understand it, the development of imagery, cameras and airplanes and balloons and that sort of thing, that maybe we're not seeing big data there in the way we understand it, but we're seeing the end of small data. I mean, that intelligence reports used to be a couple of paragraphs written by cavalry officers or a newspaper clipping from an attaché, and now you've got thousands of messages being intercepted a day, and you've got hundreds of photographs being taken a day, and you have to develop large intelligence staffs to deal with it. Would that be fair?
Well, I wouldn't call that small data. I would call that medium data.
Okay, so the end of small data, the beginning of medium data. Okay, good.
Small data is what you have to write by hand, and it's very difficult to catalog that. Medium data would be what you get with typewriters, filing cards, filing cabinets, telephones, and so forth. It's ways to organize much, much larger data sets and to begin processing them and cataloging them and cross-referencing these things. This is a revolution in business machines that takes place in the latter part of the Victorian age, the end of the 19th century, and it empowers states to be able to understand their populations and to be able to understand the populations of their colonies. For instance, the British and French get fairly good at this. Other people do as well there. So it's data on a much faster scale than anyone had ever seen. And it is a revolution. We tend to overlook it because you're talking about kilobytes worth of data instead of gigabytes worth of data, but kilobytes are still bigger than bytes. So there's something important going on there.
So, skipping forward a bit then from World War I to World War II, could you just very briefly describe, and I've got a reason for asking this, sure. but for those who may not be fully familiar with it, could you just really briefly describe the British double cross system of World War II? What was that all about? And as I say, I've got a reason for asking this.
Sure. Every nation in the 1930s and 1940s, every nation that's a major combatant in Europe, has this idea that you can salt the other society with spies. You finally figured out a way to get them into another country, which is to say by parachute, and then they can communicate by radio. So we've got this. We know how we're going to run spies now. It really does not work very well. The Germans try it. Their efforts hastily organized. The British have a double agent that helps them tremendously. And someone in Britain about 1939 or so gets the idea that we can double some of these spies back to the Germans.
So this is right at the very beginning of World War II.
Absolutely, yes. When the Germans are thinking that they're going to invade Britain in the summer of 1940, they send another hasty wave of agents into Britain. These people were very, very quickly picked up, and the British gave a few of them the choice of working for the British or being shot. And not surprisingly, a few people said, yes, I'll work for you rather than be shot or even hanged. And this is the double cross system, because now if you've got people, you've got double German spies, they have to be coordinated. They have to be run as a system, or the Germans will get wind of what you're doing there, of how you're manipulating these people here. And so you've got this handful of spies radioing reports back to German Army or Abwehr headquarters in Hamburg right up to the end of the war, right up until May of 1945, when the British Army is literally at the gates of Hamburg. And they are radioing all sorts of information about what is happening in England. A lot of the information is true. They have to give a great deal of true information so that the Germans believe that their spy network is really functioning and really producing value. Of course, the British also use it for deception. Along with a great deal of truth, there are some very important untruths that
strategically
are passed along.
Chosen.
Strategically chosen. For instance, the idea that the invasion in Normandy in June of 1944 was only a feint. The real invasion was going to come at the Pas de Calais up the Channel a few days or a few weeks later there. That's strategic deception there.
And the British, correct if I'm wrong here, are using their signals intelligence capability, the fact that they've broken into some of the key cipher systems and also code systems that the Germans are using to calibrate how well their deceptions are going over. Is that right?
Absolutely.
I guess the question I'm asking is, with the ubiquity of information means that governments, and for that matter people, and that's a topic we'll come back to towards the end of our discussion here, have, is it plausible that we could really ever expect to see us or any country totally dominating the opposition in an intelligence sense in the way that the British and their partners, the United States was a junior partner in these deceptions, did to the Germans during World War II? Or is that just an utter domination that we're not ever going to see again? Without asking you to get anything we should discuss here.
Wow, that's another great question there. I suspect that in terms of peer competitors there, somebody who is has an intelligence system and a nation around the same size and capabilities of yours, Probably that's about as good as it gets. That's the title of the chapter that covers this in my book there. But in terms of non-peers, we have a very large nation, a very powerful nation with a very good intelligence system up against a weaker nation. Yes, of course you could have that sort of domination. Yes, certainly. And I would probably point to several instances in the decades since World War II, and you can probably see them in the future as well.
During the Cold War, which ensued after the end of World War, promptly after the end of World War II, actually, among the things going on here was a big struggle between American and British intelligence and the intelligence services of the Western world generally against Soviet intelligence. How would you compare the various strengths and weaknesses of the Americans and the British on the one hand during the Cold War versus the Soviet intelligence system on the other?
Sure. The two strengths of the American-Anglo-American intelligence alliance, which is formed in World War II, which carries forward into the Cold War, those strengths are signals intelligence and all-source analysis. They can collect tremendous amounts of information through signals, and they can analyze it. They can make sense of it. They add imagery to this, especially when we start launching imagery satellites into space in the early 1960s. So we can gather a great deal of information, and you've got a pretty good expert system, a network of people trained to look at this material objectively and to pass along the important parts of it to national leaders there. Those are certainly great strengths.
To help the national leaders, if I could just interrupt for one moment, to make better decisions.
Of course.
Whether they're military decisions or diplomatic decisions or whatever.
Absolutely. This is the most dangerous phase of the Cold War. And there are people seriously believing that the Soviets are outstripping us in hydrogen bombs and jet bombers and
ICBMs.
And nuclear, and certainly in nuclear missiles. You have near hysteria in some places and sometimes there. And you've got national leaders who are able to keep calm in the midst of all this, and that is a very, very important thing.
You were going to get to weaknesses.
Weaknesses on the Anglo-American side, certainly, at least at the outset of the Cold War, we had some real problems with counterintelligence. The Soviets had us penetrated fairly well, especially in the United States, but they had some very serious British spies as well. We were able to root them out with the benefit of signals intelligence very early in the Cold War. After that, the Soviets don't get that caliber of spy again. What they do is they turn to cipher clerks, enlisted men, people working on the margins of the signals intelligence system in foreign countries and so forth, who may not completely understand the material that they're handing over to the Soviets, but can hand over some very damaging things there. Human intelligence into behind the Iron Curtain doesn't work very well for us there. We are able to recruit some notable spies, Penkovsky, Popov, people like this, but they are few and far between.
It's really hard to penetrate a police state.
It is very hard to penetrate a police state. That brings us over to the strengths and weaknesses of the Soviet and Eastern system there. The great strength is in counterintelligence. They are able to guard their own secrets very, very well. They also share secrets, these counterintelligence leads, fairly well with each other. And they've got excellent human intelligence services, probably just around the best human intelligence that the world has ever seen, although other people have matched it at points, but they're very, very good at this.
And would it be fair to say they're not so good at intelligence analysis, at making sense of deriving some decision advantage, if you will, from all of these myriad secrets that they're so good at stealing from us?
By and large, that's true, although they are very good at technological secrets. They are able to get the secrets of our factories and our laboratories and so forth to scientists who can make sense of them and use them. So that would be an exception to the rule that you stated there.
Did intelligence really matter during the Cold War, would you say, when you take it all into account? I mean, a lot of times you'll see it sort of fairly glibly dismissed as, you know, just a game of spies chasing spies for no ultimate real purpose, right? That it's a term I learned in the Pentagon years ago. It's a self-licking ice cream cone, something that exists only for its own sake. right? Would that be a fair statement, or is the world fundamentally different because of the actions of the intelligence services during the Cold War?
I would say it's not a fair statement. I would say intelligence mattered a great deal at certain times.
How so?
And places. Well, in certain instances, the Cuban Missile Crisis, for instance, Western intelligence, American intelligence, helped keep that from going nuclear, helped keep the balloon from going up, as they would have said at the time there. So in certain instances, intelligence did help there. By and large, intelligence helped keep the Cold War cold. It helped keep Western leaders confident in their ability to deter an attack from the Soviet Union and to detect a surprise attack on the German border or someplace like this there. So they're not constantly on hair trigger alert there. Intelligence helped to facilitate arms control. It gave us the confidence to start arms control with the Soviet Union. That really does not go very far until Gorbachev and Reagan are able to sit down over the over an arms control rationale, or I should say, on to talk about arms control and to realize they've got an understanding that goes beyond merely limiting arms control there. I would also argue that intelligence kept the Soviet Union alive. It helped keep the communist system going.
How so?
It helped, well, it had, certainly the Soviet intelligence system and how it was turned internally kept dissent down. It kept Eastern Europe in the Soviet orbit. It certainly helped keep control over these populations here, and it also helped to feed the delusions of Soviet leaders in the 1980s that their problems were mostly coming from the West. They were wreckers and saboteurs who were causing the Soviet economy to fail, and that disconnect between the reality of what was happening there and the picture that Soviet leaders like Andropov had in the 1980s is another reason why I think that the Soviet Union collapsed. Although this is something that the historians are going to be debating for decades now.
So on the one hand, the Soviet and Eastern European intelligence systems were, by keeping the people under surveillance and keeping them in line and keeping them from challenging the power of the Communist Party, help maintain the system, mm-hmm. perhaps you suggest longer than it might otherwise have done. On the other hand, by feeding a false picture of the world to particularly the Soviet leadership, it in some way contributed to bad strategic policymaking, probably primarily, I would imagine, on economic issues more than anything else.
Sure.
So sort of a mixed picture?
Yeah, I would say absolutely, yes. Now, obviously, intelligence is not the central driving force of the Cold War. It's not the thing that makes the Cold War happen. It's not the thing that makes the Cold War end. But to argue that it's really not important, that the intelligence efforts essentially canceled each other out and there was no net effect, I think that's false.
How about covert action? You know, a lot of people, point to the CIA plots to try and kill Hitler, or the Soviet deception to blame the Kennedy assassination on the CIA, and look at this as, adolescent boys in their respective intelligence services just sort of entertaining themselves with pranks.
Mm-hmm.
Did covert action, sort of with the benefit of hindsight looking at the Cold War, did covert action really contribute much of anything positively or negatively to the outcome of the Cold War?
In both senses, yes, it did. It did. There were several instances of I would call negative contribution there. For instance, the Bay of Pigs failed invasion of Cuba in 1961. Castro uses this as his final excuse to have no more elections in Cuba, to make sure that that is a strictly socialist state there, and he talks about that within 2 weeks, I believe it is, after the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion there. So there are certain ways in which covert action probably did more harm than good for the cause of freedom in the Cold War. At the same time, there were covert actions that had an effect, and there were covert actions that had a positive effect there. One of the factors in the collapse of the Soviet Union ultimately was the fact that the people in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe could get accurate news about the West and about what was happening in the world. This came from Radio Free Europe, and it came from other places as well. Radio Free Europe goes back to a CIA covert action that began in 1949. It was cut away from CIA. There was no association after about 1971 or so. But that began as a covert action, and rather an effective one, I think a lot of people would say.
Changing gears a little bit, in the 1970s, in the early 1970s, there were a lot of revelations about misdeeds, both alleged and actual, by many components of the U.S. intelligence community. And we saw the Church and Pike commissions on the Hill. Do you want to just reflect for a minute on the significance of, or lack thereof in the long term, of what happened in the early 1970s? Was that an important turning point in American intelligence history?
I would call that an important turning point in world intelligence history. Intelligence history, because it is the dawn of legislative oversight of intelligence businesses.
And here, the United States was leading the way in the democratic world on that.
Absolutely. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And a lot of our allied services looked upon this with horror. They were just wondering what was going to happen to the American intelligence community now that the congressman could ask questions and expect answers in public fora.
I guess it would be interesting in this context to note that at this time, the very existence of Britain's MI6, Secret Intelligence Service, was still classified. They didn't
That's
even
correct.
Admit they had an intelligence agency at the same time that the CIA is having to testify in open hearings on Capitol Hill.
That is correct. Now, they became public, I believe, in the early 1990s.
But, I think 92, maybe something
about
like that.
Yes. But for a long time, as I think it was Sir Michael Howard said, the British government maintained the fiction that intelligence is brought by the storks and enemy agents are found under cabbage leaves.
That's very good. I'm not sure I've heard that before. Do you think in time, then, that we're going to look at the revelations of Edward Snowden as having been a comparable turning point to what happened in the early 1970s? I know you're a historian, and this is current events, but if I could ask you to speculate a bit on that.
Probably not. The intelligence oversight system was essentially put in place in the 1970s and the 1980s here. Recent revelations, and I'm not just talking about ones that happened over the last year or so, but a number of over the last 6 or 7 or 8 years, they have not altered the intelligence oversight system. They've changed it on the margins. They've made it a little stricter here. They've made it more public in certain ways. It's a difference in quantity, not quality. It's a difference in degree, not in kind, I would argue.
So we talked a little bit ago about the analog revolution, and we've alluded now implicitly to, mentioning Snowden, to the internet and computers. Do you want to just talk a little bit about, in broad terms, what is the significance? How have the computer and networked computers really changed the business of intelligence?
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
That could be a book in and of itself, so I'll give you 2 minutes.
Sure. What it has done is it has changed the intelligence practice in the intelligence business, because intelligence goes where the secrets are. Intelligence goes where people want to hold value and keep information and keep things from other people here. That's where intelligence has to go. Secrets, value, wealth are increasingly created, stored, and transmitted in cyberspace. That is where intelligence has already gone. It is where it is already going there. That movement started decades ago. This is something that surprised me in my research over the last few years, is that how early that movement started.
So how early are we talking here?
Well, you had people warning about these things in the 1970s. You had people in the United States warning that Soviet agents could come in into computers remotely, perhaps even exploiting software backdoors. They didn't use quite that term there, although they did use the term Trojan horse as early as 1972, to gain information from our computer systems there. And so those warnings are there in the 1970s. President Reagan, of all people, a man born before World War I, whose centenary we're celebrating now, was the first to issue a national security decision directive, trying to govern our security in this realm here, trying to tighten computer security for the U.S. government, not just military computers, but federal computers and even critical infrastructure as well. This was 1984.
So on a somewhat related note, do you think we've seen the end of privacy? Because we all live our lives online now, too. Well, not all of us, but most of us do.
The end of privacy. Oh, my goodness. There's a book right there. Yes and no.
We're going to have a course on privacy and intelligence operations this fall, if anybody's interested.
Excellent, yes. A very good plug there. I'm going to have to come and sit in on that. We are seeing privacy change. I think the generation of my teenagers defines privacy a little differently than later generations do. I think privacy is not how much information you have out there. It's how you can control what use is made out of it there. And what people are willing to accept of that use is changing. And that's an evolution we have not yet seen the end of. It's rather fascinating to watch this here, especially when you have different generations clashing and me wondering why my daughter has 457 Facebook friends and she wondering why I don't have a Facebook account. So.
It does seem to be interesting that on the one hand, we put so much of our lives out pretty much literally on public view, and yet at the same time, people are very concerned when parties they don't like look at that data.
Mm-hmm.
And I will admit that I'm somewhat sympathetic to both of those apparently contradictory tendencies, but it does seem to me that we as a society in the developed world haven't really figured out how we feel about these issues.
That is for certain, and you're watching a public debate on this. You're watching this in the courts. You're watching this in the press. You're watching this on college campuses. It is truly an amazing thing to watch. What I would remind people that these debates were had in an earlier form over a century ago, especially with telephone and radio and so forth. You start getting people worried about these things. Even then, there's a very important case for privacy law that comes down in 1928. That's Olmsted versus the United States. And it doesn't come out the way civil libertarians necessarily wanted it to, but it is still cited in a lot of case law there and a lot of teaching about this.
The title of your book is The Rise and Fall of Intelligence. So I get the rise of intelligence part, and we've talked a good bit about that. What's the fall of intelligence? What does that mean?
Well, this is the best kind of title for a book there. It makes people look at it a second time and wonder what on earth is in that book. The rise of intelligence is this analog revolution, this digital revolution that spreads intelligence, that changes the way the business works, and spreads it all around the world in new ways. The fall of intelligence is the arc, the downward slope of an arc that really where the peak was reached perhaps in World War II when you have a couple of superpowers, the USSR and this Anglo-American Alliance for Intelligence that exists in 1945. You have them having a monopoly virtually on the ability to do intelligence at a competitive level there. No one else can come remotely close to that. As a result of the Cold War, intelligence methods are diffused out across the world as a result of this digital revolution. People are able to download tools that now allow them to collect intelligence half a world away, to bring back all sorts of secrets with minimal investment, with minimal risk to themselves. And it is a revolution that turns virtually anyone potentially into an intelligence target there. So the fall of intelligence is the fall of this intelligence monopoly here and the diffusion of intelligence all around the world so that almost anybody can practice intelligence, almost anybody can be a victim of intelligence there. We are in a different era.
So in the security studies world particularly, though not exclusively among people who study terrorism, some folks talk about a concept they call super-empowered individuals or hyper-empowered individuals. And the notion there is that not so long ago, only states could inflict the kind of, major destruction on other states. And now with the advance of technology, and one of the things they tend to point to particularly is biotechnology, but also computing technology, small groups and even eventually they predict individuals are going to be able to inflict state-sized damage on other on countries. I see you making sort of an analogous argument with regard to intelligence, not inflicting physical destruction or death, but understanding and stealing secrets and that sort of thing, that it's becoming more democratized, if you will, for better or for worse.
Certainly, certainly. That is a very good parallel right there. Last year in 2013, we saw a conspiracy, essentially a couple of brothers setting off bombs in Boston. And what was the response to that? The entire city, the entire metropolitan area was essentially put on lockdown for a long time, seemingly for those people locked in their houses right there. Just two people were able to do that to a major metropolitan center in a superpower. That is super empowerment right there. In the intelligence field right there, we've seen very small nations, very poor nations buying cyber tools, and they are able to use these things to surveil dissidents within, even here in the United States, to reach out to them and even to destroy data. To cause destructive effects half a world away. And that is, again, that's just democratization that you're talking about right there. It's a very good analogy.
Well, unfortunately, we have to end our conversation there on that provocative note. If you'd like further opportunities to pick Mike Warner's brain, I'd encourage you to buy his book, The Rise and Fall of Intelligence and International Security History, out in March, not May, from Georgetown University Press. And if you're in the market for graduate school, you can come join us here at Johns Hopkins Advanced Academic Programs, and you can study directly with Mike. Mike Warner, thank you so much for joining us here at the Global Security Podcast, and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Global Security Podcast from Johns Hopkins University. For information about our part-time graduate programs, go online to advanced.jhu.edu. We hope you'll join us next time.